Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. My name is Dr. Jamie Madigan, and I am your host. In every episode of this podcast, I explore a question at the intersection of psychology and video games with the help of my guest expert. This is the episode about the psychology of escape rooms. Just a quick reminder, you can always go to psychologyofgames.com to find more stuff like this. There's hundreds of articles and dozens of episodes of the podcast that are all there just waiting for you to check them out. And you can also go to patreon.com/POG to find out how to support me on Patreon if you like any of this. And if you do that, you'll get an ad-free version of the podcast and audio versions of each of the articles that I publish on the website delivered to you straight to your phone or your other listening device of choice. So last year, my daughter's friend had a birthday party. Not too unusual, but rather than the typical roller skating rink, Chuck E. Cheese, or that place where everybody climbs inside of giant inflatable balls and spends 40 minutes running around into each other, this party involves something that I had only recently heard about, an escape room. A group of 8 kids were locked into a room sparsely decorated with palm trees and then told that they were to pretend to be stranded on a tropical island that was threatened by an erupting volcano. They were further instructed to imagine that there was a boat on which they could escape this disaster, but the keys to that boat were hidden somewhere on the island. They had 60 minutes to find the keys or face a lethal overdose of lava. Now, rather than rooting through pants pockets or looking under couch cushions, finding the boat keys here involved solving puzzles at different stations so that they could progress to the next station and solve more puzzles before ultimately unlocking the boat to safety. One such puzzle involved using a tool to retrieve multicolored bananas from a crate, figuring out how to order the bananas according to the symbols written on them, and then intuiting that this correct sequence of colors revealed the code needed to unlock the door to the captain's quarters. A lot of stuff like that. Apparently, the birthday girl's significantly older brother rushed to dominate the puzzle solving, but even so, the group got on the boat and off the doomed island with only 2 seconds to spare. Though I have my doubts. I think the timer might have been rigged for the sake of drama. If this method of escaping an island sounds a little video gamey to you, you shouldn't be too surprised. Back in the early-ish days of PC gaming, the point-and-click adventure genre reigned supreme-ish. We didn't have your fancy 3D graphics, your loot boxes, your multiplayer matchmaking. We just had a rubber chicken with a pulley in the middle, a locked door, and a lot of determination. For over a decade, games like Myst, The Secret of Monkey Island, The King's Quest presented players with environments that demanded exploration and creative, sometimes too creative, thinking in order to master. Every room was a puzzle, or at least a piece of one, and the items that you found or inspected within the environment often told part of a story. Or if you were lucky, they gave up a clue that helped you pass a mental roadblock and allowed you to solve a puzzle so that you could move on to the next screen. In a way, these adventure games were the precursors of the escape rooms that are popping up in strip malls and warehouses all over the country. Only escape rooms take place in physical space with tangible objects. But just like with video games, people who design escape rooms and other kinds of live narrative experiences can benefit from an understanding of human psychology. What kinds of boundaries do typical human perception and information processing place on how an escape room can be best designed? How can the well-worn mental shortcuts that people use to make decisions and understand the world be used to advance a narrative or provide clues to a puzzle or help people avoid getting stuck? And then how can these concepts be looped back around to lessons that can be applied to video game design or even how to play a video game and interact with other players while trying to solve some challenge? And what about virtual reality? Can the design of escape rooms inform the design of similar experiences in VR? Don't these things have a lot in common? These are the kinds of questions that I'll be tackling this episode with the help of my guest expert. All right, everybody, welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. We've got a really interesting guest with us today. We have Laura E. Hall. She is a freelance with Timberview Productions, but she also does a lot of work around escape rooms and narrative design. She's not a psychologist. She's not an academic, but frankly, I'm glad to have somebody come on who can talk about other aspects of the psychology and video games. So it's going to be a really interesting discussion. Laura, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
So So who are you and what are you doing here? So give us a little bit of an idea to what led you to this podcast doorstep.
Right. Well, I am a writer and artist and puzzle designer, among other things, living in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And my main thing that I do right now is make escape room games.
Cool.
So it's real world, non-digital. I mean, they incorporate technology and digital elements, but it's an actual room that you go into with your friends. So you buy a ticket for this thing. There's a timer. Everything in there is a puzzle or a clue of some kind that has to be solved in that time, or you lose the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an entertainment product that has become really popular recently.
Yeah, I've seen these kind of things crop up everywhere. There's several here in my hometown, and I have not done one myself, but my kids have done it, and several of my friends have gone and done them. And they sound really cool, and they sound like they can be sort of a really interesting experience that maybe checks all of the assumptions about, oh, I'm so good at games that a lot of people have. You know, when they get into this sort of unique situation, it's like, well, wait, what do you mean I have to like figure out puzzles based on physical objects and, you know, maybe touching some stuff on a screen or, you know, sorting some letters or unscrambling some types of things.
Yeah.
So it sounds really cool. So, I mean, these puzzle rooms or escape rooms, like they came out of video games, right? I mean, video games were sort of the original escape rooms. I'm thinking back to like, you know, the classic adventure games from the 1990s, like Myst and Secret of Monkey Island and all those, mm-hmm. you know, LucasArts and other companies that made those types of adventure games. That was sort of the progenitor to modern escape rooms, right?
Yes, definitely. Like, I would not be here if it wasn't for Myst. it's extremely influential. And when people try and sort of trace the path of escape rooms specifically, this idea of like there's puzzles, the room is locked, they point at a game called The Crimson Room. It was part of a series of sort of point and click, linear connected little puzzles. It was a flash game by Toshimitsu Takagi, I think.
Sounds good to me.
from the early 2000s. But as you point out correctly, the thing that I think is driving people to escape rooms has been around a lot longer. Mm-hmm. Like for me personally, I used to play what's called alternate reality games or ARGs, which were sort of like online treasure hunts. You would like look at the source code of a website that seemed odd, and you know, there's a hidden message, and call a phone number and you'd hear a recording. And the idea with those, they were always a marketing project of some kind. You didn't necessarily know what the marketing message was, and that kind of wasn't the point of them.
Mm-hmm.
But like one of the first ones was I Love Bees, and that was for the Halo game.
Right. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. exactly what I was thinking of when you were describing that.
Yeah. And like for me, the thing that I thought was really interesting about that stuff was not even the puzzle part of it, but the ephemerality of it. Like this idea that you're coming together with this community of people, you know, you're solving all of this stuff in real time. There's a team of writers and designers sort of working behind the scenes. We call it behind the curtain, like after The Wizard of Oz. And, you know, the story often would change with you in a lot of cases based on what players were doing. So it's the sort of thing like you can read about later, but you could really only truly experience it if you were there in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always what I thought was the most interesting thing about that. I actually didn't really think of myself as a puzzle person for a really long time until I moved to Portland. There's an event here called Puzzled Pint, which is a monthly sort of puzzle paper bucket challenge, like a tabletop puzzle hunt. You solve for the location, you go to a bar with your friends, you solve puzzles. It's kind of a fun night. It's in so many cities now. There's probably one near you.
This combines two of my favorite things.
Drinking and puzzles. Yeah.
having a good, you know, beer and solving some puzzles. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, maybe hanging out with friends too.
Yeah, there's that. So with that group of people, I started doing kind of competitive puzzle hunts. I mean, you know, it's for fun.
Mm.
Like it's not like in a league or anything, but like larger and larger ones. And you do train for them by practicing it beforehand. And, you know, I kept wanting more and more of those sorts of things.
Sounds like you got hooked.
Yes.
Okay.
But we are all video game people. You know, we do a lot of theater stuff. We do these puzzle things as a kind of hobby. But the video game stuff was sort of the major connecting thread for a lot of us, and we went and participated in an escape room game. And then on the drive back, we were like, well, we could do that. Like, we are puzzle designers. We make levels. Like, we can do this thing.
Right.
The thing that was the most important to us, though, that is actually different from almost every other room that I've played, is that we have a really strong emphasis on narrative and world building and diegesis. So,
Within the
like,
puzzle rooms.
yes.
Seems like a small area to build a world in.
It can be, but I mean, the thing about these games is like you can have a really solid puzzle game and you don't need anything else necessarily. Like, it can be really fun just to go through a puzzle game and play it. Even if the puzzles are bad, you're still there hanging out with your friends. So you kind of like make your own fun out of that. So yeah, it is a small thing, but people are in there for a full hour, which is almost the length of a film. Definitely the length of like a long episode of television. So there are interesting things that you can do within that time and with that number of people participating.
So what when you go in to develop such a narrative or, world building to support that activity, what are some of the things that you have to take into consideration? Like, or another way of asking that is like, what annoying things do people do that you have to account for?
Well, there's so many things. And I should also add, we opened ours like roughly 4 years ago. So a lot of
Okay.
these things that I'm going to talk about are lessons learned. We sort of intuitively understood them when we were going into it, but it was difficult to articulate at the time. But now it's like a completely different ball game. Like, we know exactly what is going on at this point.
Yeah, that's great that somebody's learning and documenting those lessons. Yeah.
So what goes into world building and doing one of these games? Gosh, well, there's sort of fairly straightforward, simple stuff that I think is really important, which is basically just like not bringing people out of the world that you're building, right? There's a lot of stuff that comes out in play testing, which is like a major component of puzzle design. Putting puzzles in front of somebody and watching them fail to solve them, because the failure is not from the player. It's always your design that is not good enough to correctly usher them through the puzzle, right? There's a great book called Puzzle Craft that Mike Selinker wrote with another person, and there's a quote from it about people enjoying puzzles because they like to be in a painful position and then be allowed to release themselves from that pain.
Okay.
It's like scratching an itch, right? Somebody else cannot do it for you.
Right.
So you're really putting people in a position where they get to challenge themselves, and you want that to be the only challenge. You don't want other challenges to be friction from stuff in the room being broken or things being confusing. Something that you see a lot in rooms is like there'll be five padlocks and they're all the same, right? You can enter a four-digit code on any of them. So how is the player supposed to understand that it's only the one that you actually want them to do it in, right?
Right.
Like, people don't really grasp yet the directing of attention that is required for that. And in a video game, it's a lot simpler. You try and enter it doesn't work, or there's a sort of infinite number of locks and keys that you can sort of generate in a digital environment. But in the real world, there's only so many padlocks available and ways to lock a box or a container.
And video games designers have like control of a camera, or they can put things up in the HUD, or they can feed information directly to players without relying on them to find it in, physical space, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of the initial issue that I try and deal with constantly and consistently, is like eliminating friction just caused by design issues, whether that's in the puzzle or the room itself. That ties into the narrative stuff. You want people to have a sort of reason to be there for the story. Like, it doesn't even have to be that convincing because people want to suspend their disbelief. They're eager to do that because they want to engage in that world.
So give me an example of like a story or a setup for a story either that you've created or one of your favorites from an escape room. Like what might that be?
Well, in the first one that we did in 2014, you are a team of kind of like super spy agents who have been activated.
Okay.
The setting of the room is a sort of like Cold War era, 1984 Berlin Wall dystopian. The room itself is like a propaganda office, and the occupant of the office was an undercover agent who was secretly sabotaging stuff.
Okay.
So they had missed a check-in. So you are being activated to go in, investigate the office, and figure out why they have gone missing. So immediately, like, you have a reason to be there. There's a reason that there's a time limit. There's a reason that there's information hidden in the
Right.
room.
Yeah, this whole spycraft thing that automatically sets up the concept of like, okay, you're gonna have to decode or figure some things out or find some things. That's clever. Yeah.
A lot of rooms that I've seen are presented as if there's an author of the room, a fictional character, who is like, "Welcome to my challenge," right? That's sometimes like a historical figure. A lot of the time, it's a serial killer,
Yeah, shades of Saw, right?
right?
Yeah.
Very much, and like that's fine. It's not my favorite thing, because again, like the stuff that I'm designing, I want pe it's people against their best selves and their most clever selves. I don't want it to be them versus the room. Or them versus me, the creator who's watching them. It's a very common error in any kind of design, but any kind of interaction design, where somebody is interacting with it in the way that it is natural, but you don't want them to interact that way. You haven't designed it that way. And so you're thinking like, well, why are they doing this? They're wrong. But it's actually the design that's totally not correct for the situation. And being able to change that mindset is actually pretty difficult. Not thinking of the player as wrong, making adjustments to your own design to sort of accommodate whatever their true actual behavior is.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you try to get people into the mindset of, following the narrative and being there in that space and sort of becoming immersed. And this makes me think about the psychology behind, immersion, where people sort of lose track of the fact that there is something between them and the narrative or them and the experience. And they may forget that, like, oh, there's a timer and I'm in this sort of escape room. It's an artificial situation. And I imagine to the extent that you provide a strong narrative and sort of a seamless way for people to get into it, that they get more and more immersed in the experience. And that just like in video games, that's often a design goal. For the people making
Yes,
the experience.
that is absolutely the ultimate goal. To give people a sense of transportation, I think is really important. And just in a, if you'll like allow me to kind of get a little philosophical here.
Absolutely, I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
I think the real world right now, especially for a lot of people, feels kind of scary, and there's like a lot of anger happening.
Yeah, I've noticed.
And I think, in a general sense, the way that our society and our neighborhoods in particular are designed, they don't facilitate things like community and friendship. The way that neighborhoods are laid out in grids, the placement of garages, don't encourage the repeated random encounters that are how friendships are formed. Like on a college campus, that's why you're randomly seeing people on the quad or in classrooms, and that's how you make friends in those environments. But then as soon as you leave those places, you're going to your job, you're driving to your home, and then you're kind of in this little isolated bubble. So it's just that I think, in a general sense, people are kind of starving for human connections like that, right? It's very natural to want and need those things, and you really have to work hard to make that happen as an adult. And then, like, lastly, life is kind of just drudging. Like, we're all in a cycle of needing to work to support ourselves. And, there's always more laundry or more dishes or more appointments or whatever it is. So it's just to say that, like, in our real life, if you want to have feelings of excitement and magic and adventure, that's also something that you have to deliberately seek out. And that's, I think, video games, as for me, fill a lot of that role, right? You get to sort of lose yourself in those stories and be entertained for however long. So I think it becomes even more important when people are in a real world environment because it's so much more visceral and immediate. Those feelings that people are having and the things that you can draw out of people. And you really only have to look at the reactions that people have to things like Sleep No More and Meowwolf. Like people, everybody's excited about it. You maybe can get academic about it, but like everybody feels this kind of tug in your gut. It's instinctive.
So what are those games that
Oh.
you just mentioned for people that may not know?
Right. So Sleep No More is a production of Macbeth that's been running in New York City for some time. It's Promenade Immersive Theater. So it takes place in a 5 or 6 story warehouse with the entire space acting as the stage. And the show loops 3 times in the night. It's a lot of nonverbal acting and dance. And the entire audience is also masked. So you sort of, your identity is removed in a way, and you sort of have this freedom to roam and explore and touch everything and open drawers and look inside pockets. And, every part of that space is a part of the production. So it's a completely fleshed out world, but it's sort of set in a noir environment as well. It's really, really stunning. It's the pinnacle of that kind of work. And then Meowwolf is a massive art installation in Santa Fe. That one's in a, I think it's 30,000 square foot former bowling alley, but they've transformed it into. It's almost difficult to describe because this hasn't not existed before now. It's a collective environment that you experience things within, but it's also a gallery because individual artists have also done the spaces within the larger space. So you're moving through everything, but you're also simultaneously experiencing the work of individual artists. But that one starts out in this family home. A 2-story Victorian house that you walk through every part of it. And then as you start opening doors and as you start getting further into the house, it becomes more and more warped and sort of unsettling. And then it opens into this totally psychedelic rainbow, brightly lit forest. And every room is another thing. It's really an intense experience. But they're having incredible success. Because again, I really think that people are hungry for things that encourage you to feel something. And like the reaction that you can get in a real world environment is different than you can when there's a frame around it, as in a seated theater or through a television screen. So that's all just to say that I really feel a responsibility to people to provide them with this entertainment thing, to give them that sense of transportation, to not yank them out of it if we can help it at all. Because it's something that people need. People are hungry for it. So.
So when you're designing these sorts of experiences and, game, I don't know if game is the right word, but some of these things have game-like elements. They have puzzles and they have, you try to create a sense of psychological flow and so forth. So like, how do lessons from psychology or concepts from psychology come into play when you're developing these things?
Well, it's heavily influential in just how we've observed that people take in information, and how because we watch through a camera the whole time, so we can see people's behavior throughout, and there's actually a whole lot of stuff that is going on with people in those moments. For one thing, they immediately are entering a flow state, and like we induce that by having them cross a threshold into this other world. The lights are dark. It's very scene setting. And it's all theatrical cues. The language of this exists and has in theater for a long time. But they basically immediately enter this flow state, and like it affects how they're taking in information, which is to say, they are very, very limited in what they can pay attention to, which changes how we present story moments and narrative stuff. Something that's very common in any escape room is that as soon as you show up, you get handed this laminated sheet of paper, and it's a full page of text, and it's explaining all the rules and everything you're supposed to look for in the story and the characters.
I thought you were going to say it was like
And
the liability contract that they have to sign, but
oh,
that probably comes
that's the
before.
previous
Yeah.
sheets of paper, yeah.
So
I mean,
you give them a lot of information to try to digest, probably very quickly, right?
very quickly, as soon, you're feeling really excited because that timer is ticking. And that's supposed to be your introduction to the story and the world. And it works for a book, but there's not a time limit on reading a book. Like, no other medium of entertainment really tries to do that.
And there's not like a
So,
group of people standing there waiting for you to finish reading a book or
right?
playing through a scene in a game or watch a movie, right?
Exactly. Well, and if you think about, for example, the opening moments of the Star Wars films, like you get the huge scroll of text. That's fine because it's kind of cool stuff. But like the thing that you remember is the tiny little ship against the outline of the planets and the Star Destroyer and the fight that's happening. Like that is really powerful and tells you a million times more about this like little rebel alliance and this like massive empire that's got way more firepower than all of that text just did or tried to do, you know? But people in escape rooms just do not read anything and they do not absorb anything. And in our first one, we had some story moments, but it's we designed it as, where is this character in the space, right? Because it's this person whose office you're investigating and they're hiding in the building. So like, how are they communicating to you? How are you communicating to them? When do they become aware of your presence? And then how are they interacting with you? And like, it's all done through puzzle objects. You hear a tape recording that you find where they're like, if you're, it's a kind of classic, if you're listening to this, it means I'm in trouble sort of
Right.
recording. Then you send them a key card that you've reprogrammed. So for the first time, that character fictionally becomes aware that you're in their office and you're following these steps. So then they ask for your help to escape, and you kind of watch a little video of them doing that. And then they kind of abandon you. And so at that moment, your purpose in the game changes because you've been helping them. Suddenly, they don't need your help anymore. So you have a different objective. So that's all really done through what's roughly a single line per interaction. And what some of it's written, some of it's audio, some of it's video. But it's specifically because, like, if we had tried to convey any of that in just like, here's a piece of paper with 10 paragraphs on it, it doesn't have the impact or the meaning or the sense of adventure that the rest of it does, which is just like, that's how human brains work. People love
Right.
people.
Yeah, they relate to people and they can draw information from very limited, they can get a lot out of very limited information if it's about a person or about a story, more so than they can do if it's just a giant information dump. Or
Totally.
to put it another way, they can do that more easily and more quickly.
Yes. And there's a lot of like design shorthand that takes advantage of that as well. When we do set design and lighting and stuff, a lot of it is taking cues from film design because that's a visual language that people are already familiar with. And if you're designing with archetypes, it's a lot faster to just make that reference. I mean, you have to. It has to be for the right audience. So you assume that people are going to get the reference for one thing. As an example, like we reference a lot of old technology and people are starting to age out of that. So we if we put
So
a
you have
cassette
like a,
tape in
yeah, I was
it,
gonna say like a cassette tape or a typewriter or any, as Microsoft Zune or something.
yes, exactly. People really, really struggle to interact with that stuff now.
Really? Wow.
And yes, I know. I was like, oh, great. I feel old. But it's true. Like you can put it in there, but people don't necessarily know how to use it. And so like, is it worth continuing to keep it in? Because it does speak to the era that it's set in,
Right.
if you're using a cassette tape. versus people are confused and kind of, are they pulling out the tape ribbon and like, is that fun to,
Jeez.
is that type of confusion fun?
I just
So,
imagine like some kid just sitting there and unspooling an entire cassette tape on just a giant pile
yeah.
on the desk. Yeah.
It has happened.
Has
The
it really?
typewriter ribbon is the really, that one was the surprise.
That's hysterical.
People were taking apart a typewriter, and this was in playtest, so it was we let people mess with things more than we might otherwise, just for the sake of seeing what boundaries they're finding and pushing through. But somebody was like, "Oh, there'll be typewritten things on the typewriter ribbon." So they take it out and they're unspooling it and sort of wondering why their hands are getting inky. And we were like, okay, maybe we should stop them.
Step in here.
That's not the puzzle. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, making references to archetypal design is a huge part of conveying that narrative again without needing to use written stuff.
Right, 'cause I was gonna say it seems like especially in situations where people's attention and mental resources are being split up and they're trying to focus on everything and they can't, which means they can't focus on anything. The reaction a lot of people have is like, okay, I'm just gonna like zero in on this one specific thing, or I'm gonna use, what are called like cognitive heuristics or like mental rules of thumb to say like, oh, this thing is visible, so it must be important, or this thing is large, so it must be relevant, or it's placed close to me or close to this other thing. They must be related because that's how things typically happen in the real world. Have you found
Yeah.
any clever ways to sort of take advantage of those cognitive heuristics and mental shortcuts that people are prone to use, especially in highly unusual or uncertain situations?
Oh yes, definitely. And again, that's what playtesting tends to reveal. And in particular, the proximity stuff is very common. So we rearrange a lot of things just based on how people are flowing with and around it. Something that I like in puzzle games that I play, and so I put this into my own ones, is that there should be a familiar underlying structure to something. So if you're doing a solution and there's going to be extra letters in every single thing, it should always be the same number of letters. So you try it once and you're like, okay, well, there's three extra letters here. You try it again, you see that there's three extras, and then you know from that moment on to always expect three extras.
Okay. That's how you know if you're close to the solution or not, I guess. Or one
Exactly.
way, yeah.
Very much. And I also try to, generally, if you've used an object once, you can discard it safely, not needing to re-reference it unless it's obvious, that everything is referring back to something. That if you do that as a rule, and people feel confident in sort of discarding whatever they've interacted with, you can then introduce surprise later by bringing something back in a way that they were not expecting. But it has to be deliberate. You can't sort of just do it casually. Like it's part of a structure that people can sense and become familiar with in interacting with those puzzles.
So, tell me the story of the invisible gorilla. 'Cause this is one of the things that I picked up on when I watched one of your previous GDC presentations. You talked about the fact that when people sort of sit down to start trying to solve a puzzle, or they're like focusing on a certain thing in the room and trying to figure stuff out, that this concept of attentional blindness, as epitomized by the invisible gorilla, can kind of cause problems, or perhaps, if you're clever enough, can be used as leverage to get the players to do what you want. So
Yes.
tell me about that. What, how does that come up?
Well, so I'll describe the video.
Yeah.
It's presented as an attention and awareness test. So it's a bunch of students passing around a whole bunch of basketballs, and some of them are wearing black shirts and some of them are wearing white shirts. And so it asks you to focus on counting the number of times the basketballs are passed, or pass between the black shirts, or whichever sort of, version of it you're watching. There might be differences. But actually, what is going on is that there is a gorilla-suited person, like, dancing
Right.
or walking through that crowd, while that's going on, and then passing back out of the scene.
Like right up front, like
Yes.
when you go
It's
back and
not
watch the
hidden.
video, it's not like in the background, like he is through
Right.
the thick of the people, the
Yes.
crowd, right?
And then it rewinds and it says the here's a complete count, but did you notice the gorilla? And I've seen it used in social science experiments types of things, but also as a thing of like, pay attention while you're driving. There might be pedestrians or cyclists. Like, it is extremely applicable.
Right.
But yeah, it that gorilla is not hidden.
Yeah, and I think in the research that I've read, like half the people notice the gorilla, but about half don't. And each half is completely perplexed that the other half either saw it or didn't. Like they can't believe. Yeah.
Right. There's a thing in games called the magic circle, which is a concept used to describe like when people willingly enter this game space, they will basically follow any instruction that you give to them. No matter what it is, if it might be contradictory to stuff that they would normally do, but like as a part of the willingness of participating in whatever that game is, they're going to do what you tell them. And if you're telling them, look at this thing, focus on this, or solve this other whatever, often you're probably shining a light directly on the thing as well. Like, there's no reason why, when they're already, the cognitive load of puzzle solving is intense in the first place. They're in that flow state. So, like, all of the extraneous detail is falling away. And then you're also asking them to focus intensely on something, as in the gorilla experiment. They won't notice anything else. And we take advantage of that to convey the narrative stuff, by not distracting them with other things, and by showing rather than telling in a lot of those cases.
Yeah, the thing you mentioned just a minute ago about the magic circle and the fact that, when people are playing a game, they'll follow directions, they'll do whatever the game seems to want them to do. In some instances, that's led to people kind of deconstructing that concept and making games like the Stanley Parable, where like the whole point of that experience is that you don't want to do what the narrator tells you or what the game seems to want, or at least that's a valid way to play that game and it makes comments on it. And then there's like the whole BioShock thing about, would you kindly, shove this strange like needle into your arm and fill yourself with experimental serum. So have escape rooms had their BioShock moment or their Stanley Parable moment, or could there be an experience where you do try to deconstruct and undermine that magic circle and make an interesting experience out of it?
I mean, there is a set of tropes that are familiar. And so people who do these as a hobby have a certain set of expectations that it would be really fun, I think, to subvert. I did hear about one that is about like physically breaking out of the space that you're in, as if you're going through the wall of the escape room,
Oh,
and then
wow.
that becomes the puzzle game. So I think people are probably playing with it a bit. It's interesting that you ask that, because a lot of escape room design, I think, comes from people who are also interested in haunted houses. And
Ah.
horror has like a long history of self-examination and sort of playing around with tropes. But it is really something that's difficult to do in a haunted house, where you need a really high throughput of people, and
Yeah.
you're looking at these sort of vignettes that are momentary and then moving on.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned the relation with haunted houses because back towards the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned like it's fun to put ourselves in a situation where we're kind of distressed, knowing that we're going to be able to make ourselves undistressed. What was the exact quote that you?
People like putting themselves in a position of pain and then being in the position of releasing themselves from that pain.
Right. So a lot of the research that I've read about the psychology of horror, including video games and movies and haunted houses, suggests the same thing, is that one of the reason why horror is so appealing to a lot of people is that they get to be scared but know it's safe, that they won't actually be hurt, or that they will be able to eventually get off this roller coaster, or through this haunted house or out of the movie theater. and those sorts of experiences. So yeah, I could see some sort of overlap there from like a psychological, you know, emotional aspect as well.
Definitely. Something else that I'm toying with, but I'm not convinced that I'm going to start integrating it, is the idea of perhaps integrating choice and branching into the experience. So with Sleep No More, where the whole space is accessible to you, I mean, there's locked off rooms and there's sort of like one-on-one experiences that you can have. So, you know, the entire thing is not accessible, but there is constantly stuff happening. You are guaranteed to never see the entire show. It's a 3-hour long show and something is happening at every space at every moment. So, you know, it's physically impossible. So you walk away with this sense of missing out on stuff. And like, that's not my gameplay style. I'm not always like 100% catalog kind of person, but I feel the urge a lot of the time.
You want to at least see the major beats. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like that is a feeling that left me frustrated. That's deliberately designed that way on their part. But like in an escape room, you want people to be released from frustration and to not feel that tension, because frustration isn't fun, right? Mm-hmm. There's a gesture that I see a lot when people they're not solving something and they're not being hinted, and they kind of throw up their arms and they turn around and like kind of walk away. Just like this, I'm done. That's not fun. And it's actually an important belief for me because of the puzzle community that I kind of came up in. Like, fun is the point. If you're not enjoying yourself, why are you doing it? You know, that's mm-hmm. why we're all there ultimately. And like, if you're not having fun, that is a problem that needs fixing. So that's how I approach it. Like, I get the value of deliberately designing for frustration. But so one of my questions that I'm asking myself now is like, is it fun to put in a choice? It could be a moral or a story choice. It could happen at the end of a full session. So like all the puzzles are solved and you're just engaging in the story. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe it just is the difference between having one ending versus a slightly different ending. But like, I've asked people to follow this rhythm up until that moment where every single thing had one single answer, one single method of solving it. Is it too much of a break to say, well, there's one that you didn't get at that moment? Mm-hmm. You know, so even that question, I think, is something that people in escape room design are playing with and exploring. And I mean, a lot of it really just comes down to like floor space. Like, yeah, it would be very difficult to put in a second branch of something and justify having that much floor space dedicated to something that only half the people are going to see.
Right. And it's wasted on the other half. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you look at video games, I think the argument would be that, yes, like that branching or making choices during the experience that have an impact on other players or the narrative or characters that you're encountering, that a lot of gamers like that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. it's a lot easier to implement when you can literally redraw the world on the fly, you know, in a video right. game. As opposed to having to set up and staff and keep track of everything in a live production like that.
Yeah. Totally. When I was in high school, I was really interested in hypertext fiction, mm-hmm. which is a sort of like infinitely branching thing. And this is sort of stuff that was exploring the possibility of the early internet, where it's like, well, this paragraph could spawn any number of stories. And that was a huge deal at the time. But it never really caught on. And now I see games that are being written in Twine, which is another mm-hmm. text-based fiction thing that's about nodes that are connected. And branching storytelling is having a moment in these last several years because that tool is available. And like, it's just clear to me that having something that is even ever so slightly more curated than hypertext, which was just a giant explosion of links in every direction.
That's part of its charm, yeah.
Right. People want the curated experience. Like, it doesn't have to be strictly linear, but like, if it's the time limit, you know, you want something where you don't necessarily have to be in the driver's seat, but you feel like you are.
Right. Yeah, that illusion of control and agency. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show was to talk about what implications all this has for game design and maybe specifically games in VR, because it almost seems like you can come full circle where, you know, Myst and Monkey Island and all those were the first escape rooms, and then you have physical escape rooms, and now maybe some of these lessons that you've learned in developing those experiences and those challenges could be applied to developing similar experiences in virtual reality. So do you have any thoughts or any lessons learned for that type of thing?
I have so many thoughts.
Give me some of your top ones.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, VR obviously is fantastic, and I'm specifically interested in room scale VR, mm-hmm. right? Like something seated is probably more accessible to way more people, but room scale is really what I think the interesting storytelling stuff has the potential to utilize. So when I'm referring to stuff, just that's kind of what my reference point is.
Okay.
The possibilities are so vast that you can open a door and be in a completely different world, right? Like you can tell any story, but right now the tools are really not accessible to people who might want to be telling those stories, right? Like for an escape room, a real world one, anybody can put stuff in a room. And that's why you see so many escape rooms, right?
Right.
Like
this used to be a Chinese restaurant. Now it's an escape room. Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of the beauty of them in a way. Like really anybody who feels like, oh, I want to do that, they can do it because it's easily accessible. It's not quite that way with VR. And like, I feel like a lot of the technology still needs to catch up to where the ideas are.
VR doesn't have its Twine or its Unreal Engine in the same way. Yeah.
No, not at all. Because, I mean, if you look at how difficult it is just to recreate a simple room and make it interesting and make it obvious what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to interact with an object, I think that's really telling. We've designed things where just figuring out how to interact with a piece of paper is really difficult, right? Because suddenly you have to grip it, and like turning a piece of paper using a grasping headset or handset thing is actually really tough. And then how does the paper behave, right? Is it floppy or is it stiff? And like, you're already losing realism there. Mm-hmm. And then making people hold something like that up to their face really closely to read it starts to become a problem. So like, just there's no shorthand for that kind of thing yet. There is a developing language for, like, obviously, you know, the relationship of the body and like seeing a digital version of yourself and all of the presence and immersion and stuff. Mm-hmm. There is a vocabulary that is starting to come out. But there's so much more that like we have not articulated. And I don't really know what's going to make that next leap, right? I think also with VR, we have the language of cinema to rely on for things like directed attention, right? But like just the sheer generation of assets is also kind of an intimidating one. Because again, in a real life room, you can just buy a table.
Just go down to Goodwill and fully stock right? your place, right?
But there's so much more to consider when you are designing the details of everything from scratch and all of the interactions from scratch, because people assume that they can interact with it the way they would in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so it actually is a really complicated thing to make all of those adjustments and make things behave both in the way that people would interact with them, so you're not breaking realism, but also in the way you need it to behave for the game. That said, there are so many more interesting ways to lock a box in a digital environment and things that you can do that just seem magical, that like it seems like it's a natural next step for me to like explore that, right?
Right.
Like you can have a box that generates anything. You could be in the Harry Potter world instantly. And like to make something like that in the real world is basically impossible, because again, the technology there is too obvious or out of reach, right? Or like
requires too much suspension of disbelief, or yeah.
Yeah. So like VR really has potential, I think, for super, super exciting stuff.
Do you think that the things that work in, in meat space, virtual, in escape rooms will translate directly, or is it just sort of a matter of magnifying and having more options to do those, to apply those same lessons?
I mean, I think if you're going to do something in VR, there needs to be a reason why it's in VR and not in the real world, right? Like in the real world, you get texture, you get scent, you get a very real feeling of, there could be wind on your face, that kind of thing. So if you're going to do that kind of thing, a real world place in a VR environment, you probably should have the magical stuff. Because otherwise, why not just build it in a room, right? The fact that
Right.
many more people can play it is compelling one. Like all of the stuff that I make is very geographically restricted
Right.
because everyone has to come to me. In a VR thing, if I made just a literal exact duplicate, anybody could play it. But you would also be missing out on the stuff that I've put in, like the feel of stuff and the sounds that. There is a difference in experiencing it in your real life versus in the
Right. Well, I got two words for you.
headset.
Loot boxes.
That's
Has anybody experimented with
it.
loot boxes in escape rooms? Like
That's it.
microtransactions, in-room purchases or room service. See, it's already halfway
totally.
written.
Well, it's funny. There are things that mimic that, not in the same way,
Yeah.
but do you know about the game True Dungeon that runs at Gen Con?
No, tell me about it.
So that is a sort of it's essentially a LARP, like a Dungeons and Dragons style thing. You go through, I think it's a set of 7 rooms. Everybody takes on a class and has skills that are particular to their class. You're sort of role playing and puzzle solving and combating your way through these things. But everybody gets a set of tokens at the beginning, and it's like randomly assigned, and they're weapons or potions or what have you, but they're persistent. So this game, which I think has been running for 10 years, you
Wow.
can bring your tokens back from 1 year to the
Oh,
next.
wow.
And there are now vendors who come just to sell tokens of different rarities. So there is actually like a little mini economy
There's a whole
around.
economy. Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So not quite loot boxes and in-app purchases, but it's not that far off. Like,
Do you get to spend those tokens on something or
I don't know
within the
if you
game?
use them up or not. Like you as in, like you combat monsters occasionally through like tabletop shuffleboard. So you like put your weapon token into the puck, and then that's what you're using to fight. I don't know if they get spent or not, though. They
Okay.
might, to in order to continue to
Or at least sounds like
keep the rarity up.
they could be traded outside the game if nothing else. Yeah, by
Definitely.
collectors and such.
Yeah, so that's really the goal, right? Like a mini economy that forms around the stuff that you're building.
That's right. You need maybe blockchain somehow. I don't know. I don't know what that actually means. So just
I'm going to print that really big on the sign
That's
outside.
right. Blockchain escape room. People go nuts. Well, great. So what are you working on right now? And like, where should people go if they want to find out more about, the rooms that you've designed or rooms that you're working on?
Well, so my personal site is lauraehall.com. So all of my announcements and work is something I share there. My portfolio site is timberviewproductions.com. That's what I use for freelance and client work. And now that GDC is over, I am working full time on reopening our physical location here in Portland.
Oh, cool.
We opened in this building in the Southeast Industrial District in 2014, with just one room. And in the meantime, the building has been purchased and totally renovated. And we're actually going to move back in, even though it's a new owner. It's going to be in the same space and significantly larger. and better kitted out than our previous one. So that is set to open sometime later this year.
Okay.
So that's what I'm working on.
So maybe if anybody lives in the Portland or greater, Seattle or Washington State area, they can keep an eye out on your Twitter or lauraehall.com for more information about that.
Yeah, and my Twitter is the same. It's also Laura E. Hall if
Yeah.
people wanna follow me on there.
Okay. Well, that's very cool. I'm glad that I had you on to talk about this stuff because it's different in a lot of ways, and yet it's the same, right? So there's still like the same aspects of cognitive psychology and decision making and how people take in it and use information and how experiences can be deliberately designed to sort of play on that or take advantage of the way that the human mind works. And you see it happening in video games and virtual reality and escape rooms, and it's all sort of has the same root cause of human psychology. So I think it's really cool to see that sort of stuff applied to a different context like this, and then you start thinking about, okay, well, how are video games different, or how is virtual reality different, and maybe there's some stuff going on here, and maybe I should take like my design studio out and go run a few adventure rooms to sort of give us some ideas, how we can incorporate that sort of thing into our game, and take advantage of insights that other people have come up with as well.
Absolutely. And I would say too, if people are working in VR, something that we didn't really discuss is the physical impact that these games have just on the body.
Right.
Being in the flow state, people don't always recognize that they are straining themselves. After the hour is over, they're like, "Wow, my feet hurt." And it's
Right.
like, you've been on a concrete floor standing for the past hour, no sitting, no leaning. And people just don't really realize that. And like for me, that's a thing in VR that designers really have to be mindful of, because you also no longer have the external cues of daylight and people around you to cue you that you've been in there for a long time. And like if we're just transposing regular video games into a headset, I mean, regular video games are designed right now to keep you in them for as long as possible. And like that actually starts to become dangerous when you're removing that much external stuff from people's view. So I think that that's a really important lesson for people who are doing digital work that they can glean from experiencing a physical space.
Right, yeah, when you remove all those external cues, and you told the story in the GDC talk that I watched about the archery VR game where you would
Oh,
play it and you'd
yeah.
be having such a good time, and you'd eventually take it off and you're like, why do my arms hurt so much? Because you were like literally holding them up for, much longer than you were used to.
Right. And in an unnatural position, right? Like product design and UX has all of the great guidelines for how to interact with screens in front of you, right? Like the ATM screen, I think, is
Right.
a very common one to reference. Like it's very small, it's kind of like roughly waist height. You're just holding up your hand a little bit, tapping on it, and that's it.
And your interactions take like 30 seconds at most. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Anything more than that is like hugely difficult for our little T-Rex arms, you know? But it is so easy to forget that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on. This was a really cool talk, and people can go to Laura E. Hall to find out more about you, or Twitter, similar Twitter handle. Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, everybody. Thanks for making it to the end of another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast and listening. Before you go, I want to mention three things to you. Or one, remember you can go to psychologyofgames.com to find hundreds of articles and dozens of episodes of the podcast. You can find out how to follow me on social media, subscribe to the podcast, do all that kind of stuff. Two, please do these things. I'd love for you to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a review on iTunes or whatever you use to collect your podcasts. And three, remember that you can go to patreon.com/POG to support me. These episodes and every episode of the Psychology of Games podcast is written, directed, and produced by just me, so I appreciate whatever help you can offer. Thanks, and I will talk to you on the next episode.